This is the sixth and last episode of season one of The Meridian. We want to start by thanking everyone who has followed us on this journey into the world of podcasting, and we hope to be back soon with a second season. Today is the 29th of October, and as always, we're coming to you from Lund Observatory. Crossing our local Meridian in this episode, we have Paul McMillan, a Milky Way dynamics specialist from the UK who moved to Sweden back in 2014 and who quickly applied for Swedish citizenship when his home country...
you want to say that he applied for Swedish citizenship.
There we go. All right. And who quickly applied for Rebecca, can you help me?
Yeah. And who quickly applied for Swedish citizenship when his country decided to leave the EU.
Thank you. Paul is part of the Gaia team here in Lund, focusing on galactic stellar dynamics. Later in this episode, we will also take a closer look to the skies to find Atlas. Not the moon orbiting Saturn, or the comet also referred to as C2019Y4, rude, that one really rolls off the tongue, or the particle detector at CERN, or the lunar crater named Atlas, and certainly not the Titan from the Greek mythology, destined to hold up the heavens for eternity. Imagine having that for a job. No, we are looking at the star Atlas, and the stellar cluster that it belongs to.
The Meridian.
Hi, Nick.
Hey, Rebecca.
I'm very impressed with you naming Atlas for that long. You barely catched your breath.
I didn't. I almost fainted after saying it. So, yeah, thank you.
I look forward to, getting to know more about Atlas and the stellar cluster it belongs to. So.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. But I'm going to have to point out the elephant in the room. Last episode.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of sad in a way.
Yeah, it's been quite a lot of fun.
Yeah, right? I've enjoyed a lot talking to our guests, like all of the like astronomers, but also the other guests like Josephine, Joe, and Laura.
Yeah, so we had those three, and then we also had Paul, Mikael, and Jens, right?
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So,
I hope people also at the department have enjoyed the podcast so much that they want to be on it.
Yes, definitely, because there are definitely more astronomers that we could interview here. And maybe sometime, because COVID restrictions are beginning to lift, we might be able to invite a few more researchers to come and talk to us.
Yeah, like, I really sort of think we need a season two. But yeah, before actually, you know, going through this episode and interviewing Paul, I was sort of thinking, what's been happening with you recently?
So I just finished writing a bunch of observing proposals with my research group.
All right.
So we got...
For telescopes.
Yeah, for the ESO telescopes in Chile. We wrote 10 in total.
Wow, isn't that quite many?
Yeah. Mostly people usually will write one.
I've written one once and I didn't succeed, to be honest. But like, there are like a fairly amount of work you have to do for it. You know, you need to write your science case and look up the targets and...
Yeah, like a lot of things go into it because like, you know, you say, oh, I want to observe an exoplanet.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe, for example, you can't actually observe KELP-9 in the Southern Hemisphere, but WASP-189 is a target that we're really interested in.
Sure. I don't know about these planets, but sure.
So WASP-189 is an ultra-hot Jupiter that orbits very, very close to its star.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a temperature that is almost... similar to a lot of smaller dwarf stars, around 2000 Kelvin at temperature. So,
hot.
Yeah, exactly. And so these things are only transiting at certain times. So you need to figure out what best time it is you want to observe it and if it's going to be available on the sky. You then have to also specify different things like the telescope modes. So I wanted to look at WASP-189 through CryRes Plus, which is an infrared spectrograph. And that has like...
Sorry, where is CryRes on? Is it on the VLT?
It's on the VLT, yes.
Right, the very large telescope.
Very large telescope. It's
Sorry for interrupting you there.
No, that's fine. And it's got so many modes, you have to pick the right one that you want to have a look at. So we're interested in looking at the dynamics of atmospheres. But basically you start these things off with a brainstorming session of what you really want to see and what is scientifically interesting. And then you go through this process and you help each other, you reproofread and stuff. And you go slowly insane as the, you know, the hours tick by and you get pizza to come in and yeah, it's midnight.
I thought you were going to say you go slow and steady, but you said you're going slowly insane.
I think the objective is to go slow and steady, but you tend to descend into a very rapid pace towards the end. So we got our last proposal. Oh,
so that's why you occupied this room like the last couple of weeks to write those proposals.
We basically lived in this room the entire time.
That makes sense. Yeah, because you still have all of the stuff on the board. It seems like you've been brainstorming a bit.
Yes. That board is burned into my brain right now. I can see it with my eyes closed. But
oh, that's really cool. I hope you get time.
Yes,
I really
thank you.
Do. Yeah. You know, speaking of the VLT, so my research group here sort of actually decided and got approved to be part of this MOONS instrument.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, it's going to be on the next generation of VLT.
Oh, so what does MOONS do?
So MOONS is an infrared spectrograph, and I guess you know a lot about the infrared, but the sort of main feature that's so nice with the infrared is that it penetrates like the dust that we have in the Milky Way, and we can sort of see deeper and beyond those cloudy dust parts. So what I'm mostly hyped about this is that we will actually sort of penetrate beyond the middle part of the Milky Way and see sort of the backside of it.
Oh, wow. So we can actually, so the other half of the Milky Way.
Other half. So in a way, like, you know, when we didn't know what the backside of the moon looked like, then we know. And now we're probably with the moon's going to know that. So
that's so awesome. So yeah. Maybe in one day we will be able to see almost all the stars in the Milky Way. There's obviously going to be some that are a bit harder to, but you know.
Yeah, of course. No, but so I think that's super cool. And we'll also look at like planets and some extragalactic stuff.
But oh, of course. But you know, that always gets.
I'm not really as into that. Then it will, of course, look at the bulge, which is this main part of the Milky Way that I've been researching a lot. So I'm super hyped about that. And the VLT is a great telescope. So.
Yeah, it is.
So I hope you get time on it.
Yeah, I hope so too. But what's one of the biggest things about proposal writings is they're really competitive and rejection is very common. So instead of if we do get rejected, that's okay. We'll write more and we'll keep going until we get some data. And
I guess it's still a learning process, right?
It is,
So it's not just only a waste of time, hopefully.
No, exactly. And you always get feedback. And also, I think it's humbling as well because, the VLT is a huge telescope, and the fact that you can get time on it is still pretty cool, I think.
Okay, right.
Yeah. But there is one other really cool thing I wanted to mention is that I'm actually going observing myself to the Canary Islands in Spain.
You are?
Yes.
I guess the telescope?
Yeah, sure. You sure can.
Is it the Knot?
It is the Knot.
Ah, that's so cool.
It is... Yes, too many jokes get said. We're probably going to be, if it's not
observing with
the Knot. We are not observing. We're not observing if the weather is bad. But
yeah, sorry for our listeners. Yeah, so the Knot is the Nordic Optical Telescope that Sweden actually was a part of for a long time. Now we're not because, we're part of the ELT, extremely large telescope now. But me, myself, I've been to the Knot twice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an amazing telescope. So I'm a bit jealous that you're going there, actually.
Yeah, well, I would love to have you along with me if I had money.
That's fine.
We could have done the podcast up on the mountain.
But maybe if you bring the mic, you could actually do a podcast from there. Like record every evening.
You mean like some kind of journal or something like that?
Yes, like have a diary from the mountain.
That might be a really cool idea.
Yeah, and you know, then we have a great reason to have an episode or season two as well.
Yeah, so season two, you know, reporting my progress on the mountain. I think I can drag Bibi, my PhD co-partner, to help me out a bit there too.
Oh yeah, please, you know, you need a co-host.
Yeah, and as one of us is descending into madness, the other one can record that, so I think that's
that sounds amazing. Well, I guess before talking about season two, we should actually finish and wrap this up by welcoming Paul to the mic.
Yeah, and you know, for everyone who's listening, it's been really fun and we really hope that we will come back for a season two, and we hope that you've enjoyed it.
Yeah Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Rebecca. All right, and now I'd like to welcome to the mic Paul McMillan, researcher here at Lund Observatory. Welcome, Paul.
Hey.
How are you going?
Not too bad.
That's good to hear. So maybe we should get stuck into it. How about you tell us a bit about yourself? How'd you end up here in Lund?
Well, so I'm from the UK originally, and that's where I lived and worked for most of my life. I did my PhD there, and I was then working in Oxford, researching astrophysics. And I'd always been interested in astrophysics, and I was good at maths. And at a certain point, I realized, hold on, I can use this being good at maths thing to actually do something interesting, like study the stars, rather than, you know, become an accountant like my mother. This seemed like a better option.
Okay.
So I was in Oxford researching, and as is the way with astrophysicists, the reason I ended up in Lund is because there was a job in Lund that I could apply for. And it was one that particularly excited me because what I was working on was the dynamics of galaxies, particularly the dynamics of our galaxy, how all of the stars within our galaxy move and what that can tell us. And the reason I had that job, the reason that job had been funded, and the reason people were excited by the work I was doing was that there was this mission coming up from the European Space Agency called Gaia. And Gaia was going to be a huge step in mapping the Milky Way and understanding how it's built. Now, Lund is one of the centers of Gaia. It's the place where one of its original proposers worked then, and it still works, Lennart Lindgren. So the job here was to come and work on Gaia. So that was an enormously exciting thing for me. So despite being very English and very cautious about leaving a country where I'd lived my entire life, I jumped at the chance.
Yeah. It's interesting you say your mum's an accountant. My dad's an accountant. So do you think there might be some kind of link between, you know, the offspring of an accountant which leads them to astronomy?
I don't know. My brother's, well, one brother got into computing, another accountancy. My sister's a biologist. So I don't know. It's not 100%, I guess, because, you know, one of them can end up in accountancy. But maybe having an older brother who's an astronomer pushes you out of astronomy. I don't know. It must be complicated.
Okay, so there's my be a cyclical relationship going backwards and forwards. That's pretty cool. So you said you work on the Gaia satellite. So the Gaia satellite was actually something the data set I use a lot with my own master's research. It's got a lot of stars in it. On the order of how many would you say?
It's about 2 billion stars. It's slowly increasing over time, but at the moment it's about 2 billion.
And how many stars are in the Milky Way?
So we don't know exactly, because some of them are really faint and some of them are a really long way away. And then if you're really faint and a really long way away, we can't see you. So we reckon it's about 100 billion. So Gaia sees, you know, a few percent.
Wow. Okay. And did any of its predecessors do something similar to what Gaia was doing? Or like how many?
Well, there are other surveys that have looked at a large number of stars, but none of that have looked at them with such amazing accuracy. So the point about Gaia, what makes it so amazing, is that it measures the positions of these stars incredibly accurately. Accuracy equivalent to measuring where something is to within a hair's width. If that hair is in Paris and you're standing here in Lund, that's the accuracy we're talking about. And nothing had ever measured anything with that accuracy before, or anything close to that accuracy. The closest equivalent was a satellite called Hipparchos, which flew in the 1980s and 1990s, and that only looked at about 100,000 stars. So we've gone from 100,000 to 2 billion, and we've improved our accuracy by a factor of 100. So this was an enormous step.
So that, like, that level of accuracy is kind of mind-boggling. And I think, like, you know, to anyone listening to you, they wouldn't believe you that you could do that. Like, it's sort of, you know, to a hair's width in Paris. Like, how did we achieve that level of accuracy?
Well, the fundamental trick is that almost all telescopes down on Earth, or indeed in space, so Hubble, for example, a space telescope, do measure things to that sort of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
But they only do it for one patch on the sky. What Gaia does is that it does it for the whole sky, because it's a really good telescope up in space, not as good as some other telescopes in truth, but it very slowly rotates and takes pictures of the entire sky. In fact, two parts of the sky at a time. So it rotates and covers the whole sky over a period of time. And it lets you do that in a way that allows you to piece it all together.
Mm, right.
So the individual images that it takes are not extraordinary. They're really not. They're very much what you get from a good telescope here on Earth. I mean, better than a good amateur telescopes, but not as good as, you know, the top telescopes used by researchers. Yeah, it's the fact you can piece it together across the whole sky. That's what makes it so extraordinary.
So I guess what are the kind of interesting things we can learn from Gaia? So they're just tracking the positions and the movements of the stars, but like, yeah, I guess.
So there's this really big reason why that's important, which is that it's very hard to tell how far away something is. It's not something you always have to worry about when you're on Earth, but we do know, anyone who's been taught this in school or dealt with it knows that the reason that we have two eyes is that it helps with depth perception, and that helps us figure out how far away things are. When something's far away in space, we can't do the equivalent of that necessarily. We can't take two pictures of it at once and use those two together to work out how far away something is. But what we can do is take two pictures at different parts of the year. The Earth moves around the Sun, so you've got two pictures taken at different times, and the star seems to have moved on the sky just because your telescope has moved, because the Earth has moved and Gaia has moved. And that lets you work out how far away a star is by looking at the difference between those two pictures. If you don't have that, then you really can't necessarily work out how far away something is, because you can see how bright it looks to you, but you don't know how bright it is intrinsically, necessarily. So there's no other way of directly measuring the distance to a star, and that's why everyone was so excited about Gaia, because until you know the distance to a star, you really don't know much about it. You don't know how bright it really is. You don't really know what's going on with it. So that's the biggest, most exciting thing of all.
And that phenomenon is the parallax effect.
That is what it's called, yeah.
Right. Okay, cool. So I guess, is that one of the biggest reasons why Gaia is groundbreaking, or is there other reasons too? There are other hidden things within Gaia that can really...
It's a Swiss Army knife thing. It does all sorts of different things. Mm-hmm. The incredibly accurate positioning is a big part of that. And that gives you parallaxes, so distances to the stars. And it also gives you what are called proper motions, which tell you how fast the star is moving across the sky.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that will tell you how fast the star is moving sort of perpendicular to your line of sight, you know, across the sky. So that's great. But at the same time, you're measuring the brightnesses of these stars as they appear to us, again, with extraordinary accuracy, which you can do, again, for all of these 2 billion stars in a way that you couldn't do from Earth because there's no atmosphere in the way. It's a spacecraft, so you get these incredibly accurate measurements of its brightness and indeed its color. And for a decent fraction of these stars, a few percent, not all, but a good few percent, you do get spectra of the stars that are taken on board the satellite. And with those spectra, you can figure out how fast the star is moving towards or away from you, which otherwise you can't. So you're using the Doppler effect, which just shifts the wavelength of light that you're seeing by an amount that depends on how fast the star is moving towards or away from you. And you can measure the properties of the star from its spectrum as well. Its chemistry, the chemistry of its atmosphere, what it's made of, how much iron there is in the star, and some other measures of what chemicals are in there. Which elements specifically are in the atmosphere of the star, which tells you something about which elements were in the star when it was born.
Right. Have you found any weird stars?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's 2 billion. There's a lot of weird ones in there. One of the hardest problems is weeding out what's a weird star and what's just something weird that's happened to your data, so you don't necessarily know. One really exciting one that we had found that had been found before, but was not really necessarily understood, no one quite knew what it was, is an object called a Thorne-Zitkov object. A Thorne-Zitkov object is bizarre. A Thorne-Zitkov object is not a star. It's two stars.
Oh.
It's a neutron star at the heart of a red giant star. These are hypothesized. They've been thought of, and there are ways that you might expect to know that these things are these things if you see them, and that includes two main properties that they have to have. They have to be incredibly bright because these properties increase their brightness, and you have to have some measure of certain chemicals in the atmosphere of the star that have been produced inside it. And people had already measured the chemicals in the atmosphere of the star and thought, well, hold on, this looks like a Thorne-Zipkow object, but we don't know how far away it is. We don't know if it's as bright as it would need to be. And that's where Gaia comes in. So this is actually the first paper I ever wrote with Gaia data. The day after the first major Gaia data release, myself and Ross Church, who's another researcher here at London Observatory, looked at this one star, looked at actually its proper motion rather than its parallax, and we were able to work out that, yeah, actually this star is really, really far away. So it probably is a Thorne-Zipkow object.
Okay.
It probably is a neutron star at the heart of the red giant.
So it's kind of like a Jaffa of a star, like it's got an outer layer of a bigger star and a chocolatey neutron in the center, or is it a binary system?
See, yeah, it's one big star. It's a small star inside a big star, but it's very much just one thing.
Okay, well then, you said that was your first project that you worked on. What are you working on at the moment?
So, well, as is often the life of research, I'm working on a number of things, but the one that's got me most excited is related to something we saw in the last data release from Gaia.
Okay.
What we did was we looked at the movement of stars in the outer parts of the disk of our galaxy. So we looked at those stars and said, well, we don't have line of sight velocities for these stars. We don't have the radial velocities for these stars because, well, we have a few, but most of them are too faint to get that. But we do have what Gaia gives us so well. We have their distances from their parallax, and we have their proper motions, so their movements.
Mm, right.
So we know a bit about how they're moving. And from that, we were able to show for the first time that stars in the outer galaxy, stars in the outer part of the disk of our galaxy, aren't all moving in sort of a smooth group. You would expect them all to have a roughly consistent sort of set of motions. You know, it varies, but they're all sort of rotating at a certain average, around a certain average speed, and they're moving up or moving down, but more likely neither moving up nor down on average, but staying steady. What we found was, when we looked there, that there's a group of stars that are rotating fast but moving upwards, and a group of stars that are rotating slow but moving downwards.
Oh, okay.
And people had looked at this part of the galaxy before. We weren't completely new to this, but what they'd always done, as far as I can tell, is take averages of the velocities of these stars. So what you see on average is somewhere in the middle. Whereas because we had so many more stars that we could work with, because there's so many more stars seen by Gaia, we could actually say, oh, no, if you look at this, there's one clump here and one clump there. What's going on with that?
Uh-huh.
So that was very exciting and led to that question I just got asked, Ian, what's going on with that? So that's what I'm working on now. Because my first love in astronomy was making models of galaxies and trying to understand how galaxies work before I got into dealing with the data on them. So we've been making models looking at what happens if you take a disk galaxy like the Milky Way and a small satellite galaxy plunges past it and shakes it. And what happens, it turns out, can be exactly what we just described, what I just described. So we reckon we've got that figured out now.
Okay, cool. How did you see those two populations? Because you say everyone just automatically goes and takes an average. So what did you do differently that allowed you to split those two populations?
So it was very much just having enough stars that we'd observe that we could take the data and really plot out the distribution. We could make a plot of them sort of individually of their velocity going around the galaxy and their velocity going upwards and downwards in the galaxy. And we could do that for, you know, relatively small areas in the outer galaxy and still have enough stars to really see something. We could take relatively small areas and we'd still see tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of stars. And other people just didn't have that much data available to them. So if they tried to do this, then what they would have seen wouldn't really have been enough to say anything clearly. It would have been too confused. You just wouldn't have enough data to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
So we had so much data that we could plot out the diagrams of these two velocities and go, well, what's going on here? And our first answer was, something's probably going wrong here. We've probably done something wrong. But that's the way with any discovery in astrophysics. It's automatically your first assumption.
It's generally a rule I live by every morning.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So most discoveries start with someone going, well, that can't be right. I must have made a mistake. Of course, most mistakes also have that happening. So it's very hard to tell which one is going on as it happens.
Sure.
So, no, we went away and did lots of maths and checked that we'd done everything right. You know, talked to everyone I was working with, got them to check that we'd not done anything wrong. So yeah, that's how it happened. We saw this thing. We desperately tried to explain why we weren't seeing this thing, and it was actually a mistake we made. And at a certain point, we had to accept that we'd got it right.
Yeah, okay. It's cool that you can actually plot things out and sort of see things with your eyes still. And like, it's just the idea that we're still in the act of measuring things. And there's still this kind of idea that you need that scientist's intuition to build a picture of what you're looking at.
Yeah.
It's
a friend of mine who I will credit, so I'm not stealing his idea, called Ralph Schoenrich, has made the analogy that at the moment we're looking at the Milky Way, we're looking like we are scientists when they have the first good microscopes, and what we look appeared to be a completely nothing thing, and then you see a bacteria wriggling around and you identify them and you draw them and you see them, and that's the stage we're at. We're finally at the stage where we can do that. And then the next stage is, okay, now I need a theory of bacteria. Now I need a theory of germs. Now I need a theory of the Milky Way. So that's where we're heading.
So is there another mission that's going to supersede Gaia? Or is Gaia perfect? Has it gotten answers? It's going to answer all our questions in astronomy and we don't need another.
Well, Gaia is as near to perfect as... Well, no. Okay. That's not entirely fair. So... there is always hope for a future mission, and we're at the planning stages of one that I very, very sincerely hope that we're going to have in the future. It's called, at the moment it's called Gaia Near Infrared, but I think we'll go beyond that name fairly soon to something a bit more original. And the idea is basically twofold. Gaia looks at stars in optical light, so the part of the spectrum that we can see with our eyes, and that's fine, that's great, that's very, very useful, but there are big parts of our galaxy, especially towards its center, which is dusty. They're just so full of dust that's been thrown up by stars as part of their life cycle that blocks out the light from all the other stars, and this includes the galactic center, which is a very exciting place to look. That blocks out all of the optical light, but if you go to longer wavelengths, if you go to infrared radiation, then you can see through the dust, because the dust blocks the bluer light, the optical light, and it doesn't block infrared. So that's the idea of a future mission, would be able to look into these areas as well by looking in the infrared, and so explore these dark, unvisited territories of the Milky Way.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the exciting next step. A few months ago, ESA, the European Space Agency, had one of their big planning documents released called Voyage 2050, and this idea was recognized as one of the big themes that they want to go towards. So this is something we've been leading here in Lund again. David Hobbs, who is our deputy head of department, has been sort of leading this this white paper, this charge to get this mission going, and we're all very excited about that as our next big step.
Will that give us a similar amount of stars, like on the order of a billion, or will that do more? Or
more, for sure. How many more? We're still in the early planning stages, but maybe a factor of five more. I don't think we'll get to the level of the kind of jump that we had between Hipparchos and Gaia. The big reason for which is that Hipparchos existed before the age of CCDs, of the kind that we nowadays have in every digital camera.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So having them in Gaia was the big jump that made it possible to go from Hipparchos to Gaia.
I've always, a kind of personal question I've been wondering, is there a limit to how many stars we could map? Like, is there enough... Can we see it onto the other side of our galaxy, or is, do you think there's a fraction that will the stars that we'll never see in the Milky Way?
It gets harder and harder, but there's nothing that makes it impossible at any point. I guess with the exception of if there's another star in front of the star you're interested in, that one would probably be impossible. Yeah, but even then, they'll eventually move, so wait long enough and that won't be a problem. So I don't think there's a theoretical maximum other than, well, there's a theoretical maximum to the number of stars we can observe in our galaxy, which is the number of stars in our galaxy. But we're already looking at other galaxies with Gaia. The Large and Small Magellanic Clouds, which are satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, have millions of stars mapped. And even the Andromeda Galaxy, M31, the nearest Milky Way-like galaxy, we're able to map the bright stars in Andromeda with Gaia.
That's cool. Then maybe for a more fun question, do you have a favorite object or... so it could be a star, or you said dwarf galaxies, which I know do exist in the Gaia set, that you have that exists in Gaia.
So my research tends to be on sort of the big scales. It's the whole galaxy. I make models of the whole thing or large parts of it. So probably my favorite part would be not related to my work. But it is in the Gaia dataset. It's a star whose name I won't try to repeat because it's SMSJ and then a very large number. And if you looked at it, it would look like quite a boring star. It's towards the center of our galaxy. It's, you know, it's fairly bright, but it's not extraordinarily bright. And if you took a spectrum of it, you wouldn't really see anything. There's not a lot there.
Right.
But that's what makes it exciting. There are almost no elements heavier than hydrogen or helium, metals, as we call them, as astronomers call them, in this star. There's about 1/10,000th as much metal in this star as there is in the sun. It's extraordinarily metal poor, we call it. And it sits, it's living in the middle of our galaxy at the moment, and it's on an orbit that's not taking it very far from the center of our galaxy. And Gaia data is how we know that last part, by the way, because that's measured the velocity across the sky.
Okay.
So that's all very exciting. And you put those two things together, you get those pieces of information. There's two pieces of information together that tell you it's an incredibly old star. In fact, we believe it's the oldest star we've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Because the very oldest stars there wasn't a lot of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium available for it. And they were formed in what star formation started at the center of our galaxy and then spread outwards.
Yep.
So you put the fact that it's metal poor and the fact that it's at the center of our galaxy together, and you've got the fact that it must be a very incredibly old star, probably from a couple of 100 million years after the formation of the universe itself.
Wow. Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why I love that the star. The second is that my wife discovered it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
My wife is called Louise Howes. She works under that name. She is now Louise McMillan. And she was a postdoctoral researcher here in Lund. That's how we met. And as part of her PhD project, she published a Nature paper, which was the discovery of this star, this discovery of this oldest star we know in our galaxy.
Oh, wow. It's been really, really cool to hear you talk about the Gaia, and it's a fascinating instrument. I just want to say thank you so much for being on the podcast and crossing our meridian. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Looking through our telescope, we can observe and study the universe we live in. We see quasars, protoplanetary disks, variable stars, and much, much more. Today we'd like to spend a few minutes taking a closer look at one of the many wonders of the universe. Here to assist us, we have Katrin Roos, the editor of the magazine Popular Astronomy. I'd like to welcome you here, Katrin.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
So please tell us, what's captured your interest today?
So as this is the last episode, I picked a winter object that is kind of fun to look at through a small telescope or just binoculars. So the Pleiades.
Right. So, yeah, what is the Pleiades?
So it's an open cluster. So it's like a region in the sky of stars that has been created together. So in the case of this open cluster, it's very young, actually.
Is that why we can see it, or...?
We can see it because it has very many or several massive stars.
Right, and they're brighter, so yeah, that's exactly why we can see them.
So it's this cluster of like thousands of stars, actually, but most of them are very, very dim. So we see 7 of the stars, actually, with the naked eye.
Right, okay. Yeah, because I think I know which one you're talking about, because in the sky, I usually, when I was a kid, I called it like the small Big Dipper, because I think it looks like a very small Big Dipper. But I've heard that for some people, it's a bit fuzzy, but you say that you can see the 7 stars.
Yeah, well, okay, I'm one of the people for whom it's this fuzzy, so I've never seen a small Big Dipper. I see a fuzzy spot, but right. Yeah, you can actually see 7 of the stars. And if you take just the normal binoculars, you can see even more. So that's kind of cool to look at, actually.
Oh, that's cool. And I guess one of the stars in here are called Atlas, because yeah. That's what Nick mentioned in the beginning.
Exactly. So one is called Atlas, and all the 7 ones we can see have names, actually. Mm-hmm. There are others that is called Electra and Maya.
Right. Okay. But as you said, we expect to find about like 1,000 stars in there.
Yeah, exactly. But most of them are so dim.
Okay. Do you know what distance is to the cluster?
Yeah, so it's about 440 light years. We actually didn't know this for a long time. It was complicated. But now with Gaia, we have determined this pretty well. So 440 light years, that's like 100 times as far as the distance to the closest star from Earth.
Okay, so it's like, it's fairly close, but not super close.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, do you know how we find it on the sky? Yeah, I said it's like, for me, it looks like a small Big Dipper, but what sort of do you go for when you want to find it?
So you can find the constellation of Orion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you follow Orion's belt, the 3 stars, they're in the middle, and you follow them upright for a little while up in the sky,
mm-hmm.
Past the brightest star in Taurus, if you know that one.
Sure.
Otherwise, just follow Orion's belt for a while, and then you will see like a fuzzy spot for most people.
Yeah. Right, so that would be the Pleiades. Is it also called the Pleiades in Swedish?
No, in Swedish it's actually called the 7 stjärnorna, so 7 stars.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
And actually in Japanese it's called Subaru.
Oh, like the car?
Yeah, exactly. So both the car, and there is a telescope as well in Mauna Kea in Hawaii that is named after this cluster, actually.
Oh, that's cool. So in a way it's a famous cluster.
It is.
Okay, I really encourage everyone listening to this to, if you have a pair of binoculars, to go out and try to find it. I think it's very beautiful to look at. And with that, I'd like to thank you, Katrin.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And to close this season, thank you everyone for listening. The 6th and actually last episode of the first season of The Meridian was hosted by Nicolas Borsato and me, Rebecca Forsberg. Our guests today were Paul McMillan and Katrin Roos, and our producer was Anna Anadottir. If you have any comments or questions about the show, then feel free to reach out to us via our emails or via the Lund Observatory account on Twitter. In our theme at the beginning of the show, we could hear members of the 2021 Astronomic Youth Research School, which was held here in Lund back in July. The music is called Twilight and was composed by Stellar Drone. This was the final episode of Season 1. If you missed any of our episodes, you can of course find them on www.su... Oh, Nick, can you just come and help me with the last one?
Fair enough. It was www.astro.lu.se/themeridian.
Oh, yes, thank you.
No worries.
And also thank you for all of you guys who have been listening to us, and we wish you clear skies.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, and thank you, Nick.
And thank you, Rebecca.